A writer writes from his gut. His gut tells him what's good and what's merely adequate.
I don't pretend to be a critic, but Lord knows I have a gut, and my gut tells me it's simply marvelous.
And a charming gut it is.
Oh, you dog.
Oh, hello. I'm the dragon. This is FilmSack. Oh, sure.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to FilmSack, episode 332. I'm Scott Johnson, and we are mining the very depths of film entertainment for all mankind. Joining me tonight, Brian, where's my honey Dunaway?
Where is my honey? Oh, hello, lady friends. You know, every week while preparing for FilmSack, I task myself with looking for the absurd. However, this week's movie flipped my script by being so absurd that I instead spent my time pondering the fact that there really has not been any advancement in toilet technology since 1941. That is, if the toilets in this movie are to be believed, and I don't see why not. Yeah. Ah, toilet memories of my youth, or as I like to call them, the grand productive days. Yep, a sacker sacks from his gut.
Can I just say how much I like the fact that you call them toilets?
Yeah, toilets.
Yeah.
I gotta go to the toilet.
That is some serious southern comfort there.
Gotta open a window.
Yeah, open a window and use a toilet.
No, you just crack a window. You don't open it.
Oh, yeah. That's right. Just crack it just a bit. I reckon you might.
Then you bust your knuckles on the top part because somebody done nailed it halfway up.
Yep. See? Done nailed it halfway up. That's, I want that on my tombstone. Also with us, Randy Chet Jordan.
Aloha, Scott. Brian.
Hi.
Now, let me tell you something. You boys think you know what's going on right now, but you don't. Some of you are going to see through this trick, but some of you are going to ask yourselves, what is he referencing right now? And you're going to think what I'm doing is working because it gives you the feeling that there's something for you to figure out. I'll further that thought with a Bible verse. Proverbs 31:6 says, let beer be for those who are perishing, wine for those who are in anguish. And we're all in anguish, my friends. Drink up. Polishing turds is hard work. But I'll conclude this greeting with something relaxing and comforting and beautiful, because that leaves you feeling good, and maybe you'll think the whole greeting was good if it ended nice. I love you.
What's in the box, Randy?
Wow. What's in the box? Yeah, what is in that box?
What's in the box?
Finally with us.
What's in the box?
Brian, literally, I wrote this. What's in the box, Ibbot?
Nice. So I was struggling to figure out what to write for my opener this week. So went next door, had some drinks with my crazy neighbor. Then I went shopping, and then I went and picked up my free bagel, at which you can get all during the month of February from Panera Bread. Then I sat down, I watched the movie Seven. I played some PlayStation, and then I sat down, and it all finally came to me. So I wrote it down, went dancing.
Oh.
Excellent.
And got in a fight.
Yeah. That's great.
That is
great. Does Seven precede this movie? I think it comes after, right?
Yeah, 95. This was 91. Yeah.
I don't know. When was the trip to the snow?
That was 90. Well, I saw it when it was on VHS, like in 97. But I think the movie came out in 95. So this predated that by 4 or 5 years. Here's the thing. This movie here is like a piece of meat in the sandwich of Coen Brothers movies. He's got Miller's Crossing.
I think it's the lettuce.
Maybe. Okay, Crossing. That's fair. Okay, let's say the outer bread is Raising Arizona. Then you got Miller's Crossing meat. Then you have this as the lettuce, and then the other piece of bread is Fargo. And how you went from this? Yeah, go ahead.
There is a thing that I think has eaten itself, and that is listing rankings of Coen Brothers movies. Mm. It was a it was a thing kind of in the 90s that people were all like, okay, that's enough. And then it really went nuts because the Coen brothers made, you know, 10 more films.
Yeah.
And then lately I've noticed that it's come back around full circle. So like people are now saying, okay, but you can't list them anymore, right? Like there's too many. All of these rankings are different. Everybody has their different stuff. I'm just scared that this entire episode of this podcast is going to be us ranking Coen Brothers movies.
I don't think it's really a rank as much as a recipe what Scott was giving us, right?
Yeah, kind of. I mean, to me, it just feels like this weird, out of place thing. This like, the trivia says that Joel Coen, who wrote it, wrote this during a period of writer's block between Miller's Crossing and the next thing.
Oh, he argues that it was not writer's block.
What does he say it is then?
He says it was just, he said the writing for Miller's Crossing had slowed down, which happens when you're writing, and to let those characters breathe and develop, they had some other ideas and wanted to work quickly. And that's what they did with Barton Fink.
It sounds like such a euphemism for writer's block. Like, it really writing does. Slowed down. Well, why did it slow down?
The only reason why I say it is because it's on the Wikipedia. The only thing I know about Barton Fink is what I watched this week and then the 3 hours worth of reading on the Wikipedia page.
Right. Oh. The Wikipedia page has so much information.
Yeah. It's
did anyone else see the movie back in the day and is watching it a second time?
No, this is the first time.
Well, I saw it. I didn't see it in theaters, but when after. Here comes the ranking. After watching Raising Arizona and loving it, and some of the other Coen brothers, I said, "Oh, I've never seen Barton Fink. Let's rent that." And it was probably, mid '90s.
It's pretty close to
it. So it was pretty close to when it was released, but certainly didn't see it in theaters, and I couldn't make it through it. Like the first half an hour, I was like, "Oh, I'm bored. I'm going to go do something else," and I'm going to go ahead and just say it right now. I really enjoyed this movie.
Right, right.
So
and
this
I think
is
more than I think, certainly more than I think Randy and Dunaway.
Well, our taste for these things evolve, right? I felt that way about, I don't know. It reminds me of when I was a kid and I saw Empire Strikes Back and thought, this is the worst Star Wars movie ever. They ruined it. And then later, I think it's the greatest thing ever. And now that's the only one I really, really, really like, right? Yeah, it's kind of like that for me, but this has been a weird experience. So this is the first time I've seen it. I used to be, I still am the kind of guy that if there's a Coen Brothers movie, I rush out and see it. I love them. I think they're great. I've seen all of them except for the following list. Barton Fink, now that's taken care of. Burn After Reading, still haven't seen.
I want to see that.
I will see it. Some people like that thing. and the new, Being Llewyn, sorry, there's two more. Being Llewyn Davis. Or however that said.
Inside Llewyn Davis.
Yeah, inside, sorry. And then
Being Inside Llewyn Davis.
And then, it's just wrestling. but then the final one, the one I haven't seen is the newest one, that Hail Caesar deal.
Yeah.
Right.
And Randy said it was crap, right?
No.
A lot of people said it was crap.
No. Randy
Hail Caesar's
likes it.
Fine. Inside Llewyn Davis is really good. The film that I think polarizes a lot of people is A Serious Man. Mm. Because it's biblical references up the wazoo.
Yeah.
And if you don't catch any of them, it's a horribly boring movie.
Yeah. It's very slow. I liked it, but I understand what they were trying to do. And I also went in knowing that they were going for like this very Jewish Old Testament allegory thing. Right. And so I was cool with it from that level. And it felt experimental and I was okay with it. The only thing that was weird about that movie is it came right after True Grit. And here's my big overarching problem with the Coen brothers, and it's not really a problem, it's just something I run into. I'll see something brilliant from them, and then often the next thing is just weird, so different. And maybe I need to respect that, because that's them funny. Really stretching and
process.
Going new places and not being content to just be the thing Hollywood wants them to be. They want to do their own stuff, make their own ideas, and really go for it. And, you know, You can't watch Hudsucker Proxy and Miller's Crossing in the same night because you'll think you're on different planets.
Right.
So I actually looked up my review for A Serious Man that I wrote in 2009.
Wait, what?
And,
Where can we read Randy's reviews?
I
want to
read that. That's awesome.
Did I ever tell you about the time that I was a movie reviewer for a major national newspaper?
Let me finish my statement.
No.
Because Scott just said something that I used to really agree with. I had looked back at films up to that one, and it was like, I didn't like The Man Who Wasn't There. I loved Intolerable Cruelty. I didn't like Lady Killers. I loved No Country for Old Men. I didn't like Burn After Reading. I loved A Serious Man. And I'm like, my gosh, are they on a pendulum swing? Mm-hmm. Every movie is, you can tell if it's going to be good if the last one was good. Mm-hmm. If the last one was good, I'm not going to like the next one. And so I literally wrote, I hope they hurry up and make their next film and get it out of the way so we can go on to the next good one. And of course, their very next film was True Grit, which got them 10 Academy Award nominations. Mm-hmm. So they broke the string.
Yeah.
It's like Star Trek movies, right? Where it was the odd ones sucked, the even ones were great.
Yeah. In this case, it's not so much that I'd say they suck. They're just so different that if you go into them with the expectations of what you got from the last one, you just come out disappointed. Or not disappointed, but maybe just, I don't know, just smacks you in the face and goes, hey, we're totally different. Don't come in here expecting No Country for Old Men, because what we got now is goofy and weird, and then we'll be back to something normal and whatever. And those guys are making a TV 10-episode anthology Western right now for television, their first true television project outside of being producers on that Fargo deal.
A Mylar and a Buster Scruggs.
So excited.
You say that, Scott, but name the Coen Brothers movies where the lead character knows what's going on. Name one. They have tricks that they employ in their movies. And this bumbling lead character who never really quite catches up with what's going on is one of them.
Tom Hanks' character knows what's going on because he's kind of orchestrating the whole thing.
This thing where they give you something to focus on a little too much. And so you think it's high art because, like, the wallpaper peeling off the wall must be a reference to something that I just don't know what it is. And they have this camera shot of it where you're staring at it, trying to figure out what they're trying to tell you. Mm. You know, like, right. These movies are filled with tricks like that.
Well,
I don't call them tricks. I think they're doing something with films that is very similar to what you see visually in paintings. They're creating abstract art. Painting with large blocks of emotion and bits, but then they're allowing the reader or the viewer to translate that into something. And of course, us being puzzle solvers, we always want to try to solve the puzzle.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I'm hijacking that for my point because when I was a kid and I was taught art, right? Like there's like you're in fourth grade and your teacher comes in and says, this week we're going to look at ancient art.
In art class.
The thing they show you over and over is, this is what a Monet looks like. This is what a Picasso looks like. And I'm telling you, Barton Fink is the prototypical Coen Brothers movie. It looks just like other Coen Brothers movies.
It's also in there the tradition of Coen Brothers movies that are just a little bit twisted, like Blood Simple and Miller's Crossing and Fargo to some degree. They're a little more violent. They're a little more dark. There's a kind of a weird ethereal quality to it that I think I like that. I think I do. I don't know if I do sometimes.
It causes a sense of uneasiness when you're watching it. It doesn't feel like you're in a 100% safe place.
Yeah.
You get that with Fargo. You get that with Raising Arizona. You get it with Hudsucker Proxy. Mm-hmm. And
Big Lebowski.
Big Lebowski, for sure.
Yeah.
And got a cat walking in front of me. Sorry, he's blocking my notes. But it's it's that uneasy feeling that I really, really like about Coen Brothers movies because it's unpredictable. They're unpredictable. The moment you feel like you're gonna get a reprieve from the uneasiness, you don't. You just get some more weirdness that you have to kind of wrestle around. So this movie definitely lays it on thick. Like there's so much stuff that people probably think is symbolism, but it's really just them saying, oh, let's make the wallpaper peel a little bit. Let's have a mosquito buzz around his room for some unknown reason.
Well, I don't know if you guys noticed this, but I did, and then I found some confirmation on that Wikipedia article. The wallpaper in Barton's room only peels when John Goodman's character is either in the room or has just left his room.
There's symbolism, but they only travel so far with it. They never complete the line, and that's intentional. That's part of the abstraction.
But let's get to the conspiracy theories, because this is the best place to do it. Mm-hmm. Anybody have a meta on this movie?
There's one point I did feel like Barton Fink was alone in the hotel, and that everybody that he encountered was part of his imagination, especially Tyler Durden. Yeah, Charlie is his Tyler Durden.
Right.
Yeah,
I think that's a pretty good one, because it it explains a bunch of things, like the cops' behaviors toward him and how he ends up at the end with the box on the beach. Like, that's real tidy. If he's a killer and he's been writing this fantastic story all around him all along.
Yeah.
Right. I think it's a dream to the point after he falls asleep after having sex. I think the hardest thing to
explain in the movie is how he slept through her being violently murdered.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And everything post that seems like that's when it really becomes really absurd. So everything after that. So that's one of those theories, like you say.
Yeah, I think the theory is right. I think that this is totally, I assume too much, but I assume that was the entire thing, that this was just all an allegory for him. And he was the one that did it. What's in that box is the head he took off somebody.
Is he? Yeah, it was his.
Yeah.
Well, I think as allegories go, and that's not the perfect term for this, but I think it's a movie about Hollywood, right? Hollywood is the place where all of these things happen. Right. Like there's like literal bloodsuckers flying around and someone denying that they exist. You know what I mean?
Like, there's also this. I mean, that hotel, who there's one employee. Like,
right. It's Buscemi. You have to have one employee.
Yeah.
It might as well be.
Well, it may. Yeah. I'm telling you, I'd hire him in a heartbeat, but still.
There's actually two. Don't forget the elevator operator. However, there's questions if he's actually even alive or he actually even exists. I don't know.
Another fake really funny. Sure.
But yeah. Right. But plus just the quality of that hotel, like the kind of hotel it was and the gothic nature of it, and me expecting Resident Evil dogs to jump out of windows anytime. Like, it just definitely had that, like, we're not really here. It's an all exploded out version of his imagination. He doesn't really have this friend. John Goodman doesn't exist here. By the way, John Goodman doesn't age. I just want to throw that out there. That guy doesn't. Will he ever get old? I don't think so. He's going to be one of those. He's like my Asian brother. He's going to be normal, look like he's got the physique of a 15-year-old, although in his case, big fat guy, but whatever, forever, and then suddenly he'll be just a prune and fall over.
I think it's the weight loss, weight gain. His skin can't wrinkle because it doesn't know what the heck is going on. It's been beaten into submission. His skin is
like always screaming. It's just like in a constant state of scream. Yeah.
I actually started thinking that the movie was pulling a bunch of imaginary stuff from the very beginning. The very first shot is of John Turturro in his ridiculous hair standing off the side of a stage. And it takes a little while for you to realize that he is responsible for what's on the stage. Like, at first you think maybe he's an actor, maybe he's a helper. No, actually he's the director. No, wait, he's the writer. You figure out he's the writer. And you're like...
It's so blatant that he's like sitting there hanging on every word, clutching the script in his hands, mouthing along with the actors.
And the instant I figured out he was the writer, I was just like, oh, wait, what is this movie hiding from me? Because no one cares about writers.
Right.
He wouldn't even be in the room. You know, like he wrote this thing. He'd be somewhere in his little tenement in uptown. Like, this is ridiculous.
Yeah, that stuff's weird. But also. I don't know if you guys noticed this. I did right away, and then when I looked it up, I confirmed it. When he's standing staring at the stage and the actors are yelling their lines from off the camera, it's him.
Yeah.
It's him yelling.
Yeah, it is. It is
yes,
voice.
It's his voice. So that's why I was so confused.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So already I was like, okay, you wouldn't do that if you weren't doing something. You're fooling with me here, the Coen brothers.
Right. Right. In the first couple of minutes, all I could think was his hair reminding me of those box fades that we used to have during the 90s that, you know, it kind of like I was thinking maybe he was like a Jewish rap group of Kid and Pay or something. You know, it was a little bit of a homage or knockoff.
Did
it
you
was,
say kid, that, and, kid and pay or kid and play?
Kid, yeah. Kid and pay.
Okay. Kid and pay.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a much
Jewish knockoff band.
It's a Jewish knockoff band called Kid and Play. That's amazing. Yeah. Like right away, they were already starting to do it. And so it just always had this feeling of like, he's nuts. He's losing it. And then right. him staring at that photo all the time or that painting.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I just thought, all right, that painting's going to come up again. I don't know in what way. And the minute he got out on the beach and a girl walked by, I went, well, there we go. She's going to plop down and take the position.
So the problem.
Assume the position. Lee.
Good job, Scott.
Yep.
But there's a big problem with the meta, and that is that it allows anybody to interpret anything they want any way they want. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that that's really good storytelling if it's just like, oh, well, you know, you might think that what's his name? John Goodman is the devil, you know, John Badman. And I might think that actually, you know, he's just a figment. And what, you know, we don't end up with a good experience, right? Because we're not watching the same movie.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, we don't end up with necessarily a shared experience other than we all go, what just happened? but yeah, I think, but the experience itself of, I don't know. Yeah, it didn't permeate any popular culture. This movie didn't. It's really not like a cult classic. It's just kind of a It's just an art house.
I'll tell you what I thought it was. I had the wrong idea what it was. I went in thinking, oh, this is about a guy with writer's block. That's the entire thing, and it kind of was. Yeah, but
this was a statement. This was a statement by the Coen brothers about how they felt like the current atmosphere in Hollywood about writers were slaves, essentially. Mm-hmm. So this is some commentary from them. Well, so and they kind of, definitely a little bit of
that was an era when they kind of were like today. We prop these up. We prop up movie writers almost as highly as we do directors, and you know we talk about the writers a lot. Back in the day, who the hell knew who wrote anything? Like that was just not a thing you cared about. The only time you did was some art house movie where the guy directed, wrote, and starred in it, and you were like, oh, look at that guy, he's a multi talented whatever. But you never heard about the guy. You know, you never heard about Lawrence Kasdan writing Star Wars: Empire Strikes Back because nobody knew who the hell he was, and nobody cared then to talk about it. Now we look back, and go, "Oh, what a venerable writer! Thank goodness Lawrence Kasdan had his hand in the salad."
Right.
I think there's also seasons for movies. Mm-hmm. I've been noticing that this movie came out around the same time as the first Gulf War. And I have a feeling that a lot of people weren't into movies like this at the time. And another one for them is The Man Who Wasn't There came out right after 9/11.
Yeah, it did.
And
that movie's great. I love that one. That's one of my favorites.
Whereas when you look at like their streak, like Hudsucker Proxy, Fargo, Big Lebowski, it's during the later 90s when the economy was going great and people were making money. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And so I often wonder if there's kind of the better seasons for movies than others.
Oh, absolutely.
And if you take a long timeline, you're going to see rises and dips.
That's part of the studio's job is to know when to release what kind of content to the public. Absolutely.
Totally. Maybe
it
maybe
was really, it was really maybe hard more to than see 30. Movies at.
Oh, go ahead. I was just going to agree with Brian. Maybe more than 30 years ago, I think now movies release date is set before the movie even starts filming.
No, absolutely. Yeah,
and they just, the studio has no control from that point forward.
Yeah. If you announce a new Marvel movie today, you already have in your head May of next year. Like you're just planning. Right.
Right. You know it.
Yeah. Yeah. And movies are weird now. I'll tell you that. Anyway, Brian Ibbett, you were saying something.
Yeah. Just kind of going back on what Brandon Randy were saying, it was really hard seeing movies after 9/11. I bet we probably each can remember the first movie we saw after 9/11.
Think the first
one. At least the first time you went into a theater, I should say, as opposed to watching at home.
Yeah. I remember that being kind of a big deal. I think it may have been Harry Potter. Maybe.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I think it may have been one of the maybe the first Harry Potter movie, I think, was that year.
Wow, because those things all came out around wasn't Christmas the one where time, he, so you, yeah. you stayed out of theaters for quite a while.
Yeah, but I wasn't, like, going all the time or anything. Like, it's like now for me. I just don't. I have spates. Like, summer movies hit, and I'll be like, all right, we're going to all of them. Let's go. And then the rest of the year, I'm like, I'm not going anywhere near that damn place. I'm gonna... So I think that's what that was. And I remember it being a little bit weird, you know?
I didn't see a movie for like 6 or 7 weeks. Mm. And I was in a time in my life when I was watching 100 new movies a year. and I just I couldn't do it. And I remember really clearly, I remember going to see Monsters, Inc. was the next movie after 9/11. And I remember having it be kind of cathartic, you know, like forgetting about the rest of the world for a while is my experience with that movie.
Yeah.
First one I saw in theaters was Rat Race. I had a 6-hour layover in Houston flying somewhere. And so my parents who live there met me at the airport, and then we went down and got dinner, and we're like, well, let's go see a movie. And like among all the movies that they had out at the time, and this was probably late September, maybe early October, I was looking to see when the release date was, and it was August 17th. So it was just a couple of weeks before everything happened. But out of looking at all the movies at the time, we're like, this looks like it's going to be the least possibly offensive, or least, you know, the least, you know, there's not going to be somebody in an airplane crashing into a building. There was somebody in an airplane that was almost crashing, but it you know, seemed like, the thing at the time that we kind of all needed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's interesting that this was, well, so 91 was a time when John Turturro looked 15. So
it, oh my goodness,
this movie threw me off in a way that I didn't expect it to, which was I didn't expect it to feel that feels not that long ago to me in a way that I know everyone's like, oh man, it's like yesterday, but really 91 doesn't feel that long ago. Mm-hmm. So to see this and realize it's just barely on the tip of the 80s just freaking ended, man. There's like, you know, we're barely into the 90s and there it is. And everybody's
still plenty
young.
Of things wrapped in fuchsia.
Yeah. At this time. Right. And this was before Buscemi really was anybody. Like, he was just getting cranking. Yeah. So
he was still shining shoes at the Hotel Earl.
Yeah, and he was 6-7 years away from being, you know, you shot me in the face, or being a big part of Fargo. So I feel like this was like the beginning of Buscemi, and we were about to see him explode into Hollywood as the single ugliest actor ever to work. But yeah, I mean that's. I don't know. I don't know what I had this weird experience of this movie where I just went, oh my gosh, 91's not that long ago, is it? It is. Oh my Lord. It's so long ago now.
It's so weird to do the doubling trick where you're like, okay, so that was 26 years ago. In 91, we're talking about 1965.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Oh, was that the year it was set? I didn't ever.
No, I'm just saying from the perspective of living in 1991, 26 years before that was 1965, which seems ancient.
Yeah.
When you're in 1991.
Yeah. Oh,
totally. So there must be people, we call them millennials, who think of 1991 as ancient, right?
Well, I guess so. Or do they? But like, I feel like there's a longer tail to modern times. Like, I feel like the difference between 1955 and Marty's 1985 in Back to the Future is so much different than 85 to 2005.
I think our movies have a longer tail on them as opposed to movies from the 60s. I don't have a lot of memories of movies from the 60s growing up, but these kids with Netflix and all their access to movies, these movies from the 80s and 90s and the 2000s just have a longer tail.
I think we're just evening out. I think society, generally speaking, I'm not saying we're plateauing, but we're hitting a place where it's not rapid growth and rapid change. It's now a slower uphill.
Just look at our toilets.
Yeah, look at our toilets.
Yeah.
Toilets. But you know what I mean? Like the 20 years ago is not that different than today, but 20 years before 20 years ago was hugely different. So to me, that's what's throwing me off. Anything like 90 and forward just doesn't feel, and I'm willing to admit it could be just purely my own perception. And it probably
is. No, it absolutely is.
Yeah, it must be. it must be. I mean, it can't be any other thing, I'm guessing. No,
I think what you say makes sense about the evening out. I think there's something to that because so much of what we defined us as a generation is now so easily available to everybody. Mm-hmm, you know, we had to go to the movies and we had that experience going to the movies and seeing Ghostbusters and going to Back to the Future and stuff like that. But it has become so easy for people of any age to just absorb that now and get that experience immediately without the buildup that we had growing up. So I think there is an evening out of all that.
It's also
the only way I knew anything about the 60s was either in my you know, my stodgy old history book or my mom talking. And it's like, Mom, shut up. I'm like, I don't care. Yeah.
No, I mean, yeah. And plus you gain an appreciation for some of that stuff later. This movie was notable for winning all three major awards at the Cannes Film Festival that year, or Cannes, however you say it. It won the Palme d'Or, the Best Director and Best Actor awards, and was unanimously chosen for that Palme. I don't know how you say it. Palme d'Or. Yeah.
Palme d'Or.
Which is a
Palme d'Or. You heard me.
Palme d'Or. That's a big deal at the time. You know, I wonder, looking back, was it just everybody was in love with the Coens at the time and there was just no losing for those guys or something? Maybe. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I'm not saying this is the worst of the Coen brothers movies, and I'm with Brian that I enjoyed it more than I thought I would, but I don't, you know, I wouldn't put it in my top three.
No. I looked at a lot of lists. Again, I don't want to make lists, but I looked at a bunch of them just to get a sense after watching this movie, because I came out of this movie like, oh, so that's the Coen brothers' worst movie, right? And then I thought a bit and went, no, it can't be. That, I'm sorry. That it can't be the worst. And looking at lists, it's really polarized. Like, if you're a film snob, this is in their top five. Oh, if you're just an average moviegoer, it's in their bottom five.
Which is funny, because that's what this movie is all about, the intellectual versus the common man. And that's the real theme that runs this movie. And it's just a discussion. It's just an open, abstract discussion that they seem to be having with themselves about you know, being an intellectual, being in your mind versus being the common man and understanding and listening and all these ideas they just throw into this big Barton Fink stew.
Well, what do you think of the part of the stew that involves Frasier's dad being a drunk crazy?
I love that. It's hilarious to see him, that, you know, Frasier's dad is gonna age like about 40 years in only a matter of 2 years when he appears on Frasier, because in Frasier he's hurt and he's walking around with a cane. And in this movie he seems so much younger. I mean, like 20 or 30 years younger. But, you know, it's only a matter of a couple of years in real life.
Yeah, no, that's true. I found his performance delightful. I think you totally.
It was great. Him singing Black Joe. That whole. I mean, he was always singing and always in the background, just yelling. And
where's
just
my honey? Where's my honey?
Also, is
lapping me.
Let me tell you this: if there is a dude in a bathroom hurling like that, I do not go sneak over there and try to check out what's up. I get the H out.
Right. Is this where we get to guess what grossed Scott out? Because
I'm pretty sure
vomit breath is several instances in this movie.
Right,
would
there's
be
a lot
right
of puking in this film. Yeah,
and it was made worse when Frasier's dad goes, "Pardon the odor." Like, no. Yeah. Don't tell me about it. Just, I know.
I just want to make sure that we're all aware, because I don't want to hear the comments on it, that that character is based on William Faulkner.
Yeah.
Faulkner was the celebrated author in the 20s and 30s. If you go to the Wikipedia page for William Faulkner, you will see a picture of him from 1954 that they must have based Frasier's dad's look on,
because
it's shockingly similar.
Well, it just looks like John Mahoney. I mean, it's not like wow, they really made John Mahoney look like William Faulkner. No, it's wow, that looks like John Mahoney with a mustache.
Great job. Yeah. Speaking of mustaches, pencil mustaches, they need to make them a comeback. I mean, we need those pencil thin.
You think so? Oh, by the way, freaking Tony Shalhoub in this was like a very different Tony Shalhoub than I'm used to.
Yes. Oh, totally.
He was great. Now, those were all very Coen-esque, like the way he behaved, the guy in the elevator, kind of oddball, screwy conversations that you would have on the periphery. I mean, that stuff could be taken from just about any Coen brothers movie. And those were the parts that kind of made me, I don't know, I felt okay. It was like, oh, yeah, that's right. This is a Coen brothers movie. That's right. I can listen to these weirdos say things. It's uncomfortable and strange, but this is totally them. And I was cool with that. I liked that. That tied it together for me. If this movie had less of that, it would be way less interesting to me. Like, I would have walked away a lot longer. By the way, grossest thing. So there's two gross things.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. I got it.
Okay. I've got a follow-up, too.
I've got the top two, and I'll tell you what. I'll tell you there's a top three. Third on the list is Mahoney yakking.
Okay.
Right. Okay, interesting.
Is one of the other two the kneeling on the... the PP pad on the floor.
No, no. Nice, although the bathroom floor. It was okay. A runner up. It's up there because I don't like I don't like him picking that up and putting it back in his pocket. That really bothered me. But
is it the shameful walk down the smelly hotel hall with all the shoes out to be polished?
No, that didn't bother me.
Because that looked pretty rank.
No, but now that you say that, I'm visualizing the stench in that hallway.
Yeah.
There should be like little stink lines radiating up from all those shoes.
1940s shoes. That place was already sweaty. There was no air conditioning. Right.
Good 20 years before the odor eater was invented.
Yeah. Yeah, that's pretty gross. But for me, so Randy, any guesses?
Yeah, I just want to state when I was the most grossed out, although I have to actually list two, because it was later I found myself being even more grossed out by the fact that he's clearly sleeping on the bed with the huge blood stain.
Yeah.
Going forward after that spot.
Yeah. That's pretty
but
gross.
Anyway, when I think I was most grossed out was when he first discovers that the wallpaper is not very great.
Ding, ding, ding. Keep
there's
going.
Like jism coming down the wall and he gets it all over his fingers and then he's just like he smells it and he's like huh he okay
nailed
instead
it.
Of instead of rushing to the bathroom and taking a steam shower immediately.
No, you nailed it. That's my number two pick. It's my number two pick and it almost got like my number one pick. Yeah. It was almost my number one.
I just love hearing Randy put an M at the end. I mean, I know, the common terminology, the original term did have an M at the end, but I think these days you could just say the first syllable of that word.
You think so? Yeah. Oh, of jism?
Yeah. But the M but the M at the end makes it kind of like anything that sort of has this sticky consistency.
Gotcha. Okay.
You
know what I mean? Like, no, it adds to the squirm factor for sure for me. Yeah. But you're not wrong. That freaking grossed me out, and it was disgusting. But that is the pornography. What I like is the so. All right. So here are my top two, and they basically share a seat. Okay, it's that and John Goodman's barf. That just about put me in the hospital. I was just like, oh my gosh, I cannot hear John Goodman putting his lunch in a tank. And here's the other thing: when he's doing that, all I could think of was, no, wait a minute. Then maybe he's not the guy.
Why would he be all
upset and freaked out about this? And so maybe that feeds into the whole Barton Fink just has a narrative about who does what and when they do it, and it's not all that consistent. And him yakking over there, I could barely handle it. I almost had to freaking pause and leave.
The puke didn't. Him puking didn't bother me, but the fact that he came right back and got right in Barton Fink's face and started talking to him, I was like, my God.
All right, Barton. So we got to get in here.
Dude, that's so bad. So between that and like, also, why is your wallpaper sticky and wet in the first place? Like, what is wrong with this hotel? Like, what is going on in there?
I don't know what they hung wallpaper up in 1941 with. I don't.
Apparently, jism.
Right. Apparently, we got a job up in 621 Bushimi. Yes.
Jism magazines. These magazines up to 601 and hang some wallpaper.
It seems like the word jism is from the 40s. Like somebody's back there. You know what that looks like? That looks like a lot of jism there. That's what that looks like.
I spent the whole movie wondering, why did he turn down the studio boss when the studio boss is like, we got to put him in a better hotel? Why did he turn him down?
Well, that was his own place, less Hollywood.
He was an artist. He had to suffer. That was his idea. Yeah. He had to be with the common man.
Okay, but then why did he keep turning him down? Like, you think after a couple more days, he's going to go, okay, I changed my mind. I don't want to be there.
He refuses to identify himself with the problem, which is the studio execs. He wants to assume his identity with the common man, and he just, that's his struggle in his head the whole time.
Well, everything we've just talked about makes me not want to eat lunch today. I'm just not interested in food.
You don't want some chicken fat that smells like oak or something?
Nope.
You don't want that?
No, I don't want that. Definitely don't want that. So what else? We got some other trivia. The Barton Fink, or when Barton is watching dailies for The Devil on the Canvas, the black and white dailies he was watching, there's a brief but very clear glimpse, and I paused it and saw it, of a slate for Barton Fink with the names Joel and Roger Deakins on it. So they used one of the actual movie slates when he was going, something on the thing, take two, and the guy would run. It was slate was just the one they were using for the movie. Yeah.
Take two, funny. Take three, take four, poof, take five, poof.
That guy was great.
I love your animated GIF, by the, your little GIF, your GIF, however you want to say it.
Let's go. It. What does he say? Bring it. Oh yeah, bring it.
Bring it.
Bring it.
The Cohen. Let's see. Bruce Campbell says in his autobiography that he unsuccessfully auditioned for a cameo role. Why that came up in his book, I'll never understand. Right. That's weird.
Unsuccessful.
Right, exactly.
Failures.
Yeah, it's really weird.
I wanted to be in Star Wars.
I think Bruce Campbell, but don't forget.
Chapter 2.
Bruce Campbell ended up in Hudsucker Proxy, what, a year and a half later. So he got his, you know, he got his Coen Brothers movie, and he's great in it.
He is great in it.
Coen Brothers former cinematographer Barry Sonnenfeld, known for big Hollywood movies like Wild Wild West and Men in Black series is his. Anyway, he was unable to shoot this film. He was busy directing The Addams Family, which we've seen on this show. And I've forgotten that Barry Sonnenfeld was their cinematographer for everything up to Barton Fink.
That's only like three movies.
Well, it's no
good stuff.
It's Blood Simple. It's Raising Arizona. It's Miller's Crossing. Oh yeah, three movies.
Anyway,
but that's okay. We don't do lists in the
in the restaurant. Though. It's Barry Sonnenfeld in the restaurant carrying the sign that says, like, is ringing it, the bell and carrying the sign that says Barton Fink.
That intrigued me. I tried to figure that out. Is that something that was common during the 40s? That's what you would do. You walk.
I guess it's funny because it seems like it would be less intrusive to just go Barton Fink.
Yeah.
Barton
yeah,
Fink. Right? Than to ring a freaking loud bell while people are eating.
Yeah, that seemed annoying. That cafe also, something about that cafe made me not want to eat. I can't explain why. I don't know what. It was something
that guy
about
with
it.
The pencil-thin mustache.
Maybe.
That's what did
it. Totoro later explained with his Barton, let's see. Oh, appeared with his Barton Fink co-star Tony Shalhoub in the USA detective comedy drama, Monk.
Yeah.
They were brothers.
They were brothers.
USA, we like characters.
Yeah. and we saw his real brother, Nicholas Totoro, in the football Adam Sandler deal,
the longest yard.
And that was the day that we all, I don't think any of us knew that at the time, but I didn't know they were brothers. I had no freaking idea. And they still to this minute, I'm like, they don't look anything like each other. And by the way,
they look a lot like each other.
I don't think
so. Are you kidding?
He's like a little short, fat. He's a little short, fat looking, almost Latino looking guy. Nicholas does.
Right.
And his brother looks like this skinny, twiggy Jewish dude.
Jewish.
Yeah.
Right. I've never put the two together. It's never.
No, it's true.
Never in my head. Not once ever. But.
Right. I wonder if I brought, you know, a bunch of people that looked vaguely like me, if you could pick my brother out of a lineup.
Oh, I'd love to see a picture of your brother. I love seeing pictures of people's siblings that I have known for a long time. It's always weird for me to see those. I wouldn't mind seeing that. Send me a picture of your brother. I just want to do it. I want to feel it. I want to
send you
like.
Several pictures of people and see if you can guess which one my brother is.
Because the experience I often have is like...
well, that one's clearly Nick Turturro.
Who's the girl that was a Disney girl for a long time and then she left, now she had a baby. She seems nice. And her sister was in Napoleon Dynamite. What's her name?
Blonde.
You know who I mean, right?
Yes, she was on Blossom.
No.
But not she wasn't didn't play Blossom.
No, yeah, she may have been on it, but didn't she wasn't.
She was
Blossom.
The friend, right? Six or something?
Maybe. I can't remember her name, but anyway, her sister who's
Tina
in Napoleon.
Margarino?
No, not her. Tina's sister.
Watching some middle aged men trying to remember Blossom is the greatest joy I can have today.
Her sister is in Napoleon Dynamite, and when I see her, I want to say it's her name's Haley or Hallie or Hibberon. I can't think of it. Wow, it's gonna drive me crazy.
Haley Duff
that's it. The Duff sisters.
Okay,
that's the
Hillary and Haley.
That's the dissonance I have when I see Hillary Duff and then I see later this Haley Duff and I go, oh, weird. It's like Uncanny Valley. It's like
okay, but they also look like sisters. I wonder what you think of your own daughters. Like, they look like sisters. This is
I don't know about that. A lot of people,
how similar are people supposed to look with their siblings?
I don't know that the daughter's example holds up because one of my daughters is almost my height and the other one is stuck at like, you know, little tiny height.
I'm with Scott. I don't recognize family resemblance until people are standing right next to each other.
I need them right there. Yeah. That's what I need. So if I saw Randy and his brother standing together, I would probably go, oh yeah, I see it.
Right.
But if I saw a picture of them, I'm not sure I could. I think it's me. It's me, not you. It's me. All right. What else? Oh, Barton.
I'm trying to think of an example of where two brothers really look the same. Oh, the Hemsworths.
Yeah,
they
absolutely.
Look really well, two-thirds.
Two-thirds of them do. Bunky or whatever his name is, it's on Westworld. He doesn't look anything Bobo. Like that. Bobo, yeah.
I'm curious about how we developed this expectation that it's going to be, you know, but that Paul Walker's brother is going to be able to just play Paul Walker.
I have this problem watching the Baldwin brothers. They all look different to me.
What about Jeremy London and his brother look very similar?
Well, they're twins, so they better look similar. Yeah, they're literally twins. They both finished each other's roles before.
They could be twins. Yeah. They look so much alike.
They look so much alike. They're like twins.
They it's look almost like as if Danny DeVito and Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Yeah, they're straight up identical twins. They look a little different now because one got real fat and weird, and the other one took drugs, so they kind of look different now. But what's another good example? There's another one that was just the top of my tongue or top of my head here. There's another set of brothers. Oh. Whenever I see Ron Howard and Clint Howard in the same room.
Oh, yeah.
That's so I can't see it. It's just not there for me.
Somebody's the milkman, son, I'm telling you. Just like at the intro of this movie.
Yeah, somebody's Floyd.
Why is the milkman on stage?
Yeah, I say it's Floyd. Floyd is the father, the real father of Clint.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
Can we give? We got to give Dunaway credit for why is the milkman on stage? That is a great question.
for the
beginning of this movie.
Why?
What's
is
up,
the
milkman? What are you doing here?
Why is the milkman on stage? It's a really good esoteric question you should ask for all time. Every man should ask himself at least once in his life, why is the milkman on stage?
Half of these kids are mine.
That's really great. All right. What else? I wrote a thing here. Oh, I said his hair, which Randy has gone on record now a few times saying he doesn't like his hair. He reminds me of Egon this whole time. I was just seeing Egon.
Yeah. Oh, that's a good comparison.
It's flat out.
Yeah.
And it's only like 3 years after Ghostbusters or something. Okay, maybe 5 years, 10 years after Ghostbusters. But like it's flat. He looks just like him.
He could have been Egon. He could have played Egon with that hair. It was crazy.
Could have been in Ghostbusters 3 if they hadn't have screwed it up.
Jacked that up, man.
Should have been back in the 90s.
Any other comments or thoughts? I my notes were relatively shy this time.
A little sparse. Oh yeah, it's hard. It was really harder to write notes for me. Certainly was.
Mine
stressful. It was a stressful film.
Yeah. I can't even take notes.
And I like terms like soup to nuts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Soup to nuts is good.
All balled up.
Yep. All balled up is good. Those are good.
I had a coworker of mine who used to say that all the time. And it was before, apparently before I saw this movie. And he used to say, that's not a phrase. Nothing is like all balled up.
Mm. Right.
And
they definitely gave John Goodman all the great lines, like could be a pip. Mm-hmm. I can feel my butt getting sore already.
That's a great line. It means you're bored, right? Because you have to sit there and endure something.
Right. Yeah. It's very old timey.
I can see you feel pretty strongly about it, which was my favorite when he delivered that because he wouldn't shut up, and that was great. And then also is my favorite line from John Goodman, Heil Hitler, at the end. Of like,
why? What? Why did he say that?
I don't know.
That was just like a red herring. But it's funny. The entire time I was watching that end scene with John Goodman, where the hotel was bursting into flames, and he was still just going about his business, all I could think about was the meme that goes around from the gun show comic where the dog is sitting in the fire and he goes, this is fine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
By the way, there's no way in hell. This is the other thing we need to talk about this. He set that entire place on fire. Let's assume it was Barton Fink who did it. And it was like Fight Club. Fine. Whatever. Whoever set it on fire. That thing is on fire from the elevator.
The ground up.
All the way down to the other end. And somehow spread in a way that makes me think the stuff holding the paper up was actually some sort of gas.
Right, because it kind of traveled like veins, like blood through veins down the wall.
Which was kind of cool. It was pretty neat. But how did Barton Fink get out of there? How did he get down? Right. There's no way out.
Right.
The whole place is in shambles. Yeah. It's on fire. You'd be
dead. There's several. It's only the last of many times in the movie where I'm like, is he dead now? And we're seeing the afterlife, the end obviously feels like the afterlife, but there's a good turning point where he meets the cops for the first time.
Yeah.
where I'm like, oh, what if this is the afterlife now? The hotel itself, when he first checks into it, I'm like, what if he's now in purgatory, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, that hit me several times.
Well, that's the only way the fire thing works for me then, because there's no way you get out of there. Like, he was probably already dead, and the way the photo came to life, like he's dead. That's the thing.
This is 1940s, and that hotel is already old. I guarantee you, if there was any fire, there would be an immense amount of smoke. I mean, everything in there would just be, like, just black, sooty, mm-hmm. asbestos smoke.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Everywhere.
He would die. If he didn't die then, he died at some other point. But I'm going to go
with
the
theory. But that's applying logic.
Right, but I'm gonna go with the theory that he died that he died in the fire. It was his own fire he set. The symbology of John Goodman walking back into his room, I think, is the symbology of, all right, now that alter ego is dead. I'm now dead.
I'm putting that other character away.
I like that idea that he actually is hallucinating, falls asleep after having sex with Audrey, and then there's a hotel fire. And it slowly creeps into his subconscious, and that's how he dies. I like that theory. That's a good theory.
Speaking of Audrey, can I have a trope alert?
Sure. Let me pull that one right up here. That's this sound.
I always notice when there's only one woman in the world, but it's particularly obvious when there's only one woman in the world, and it's 80 years ago, but she's a sexual aggressor who literally leaves her live-in boyfriend in the middle of the night to go have sex with someone else, someone she just met. Mm-hmm. That it is just mind-blowing, this trope to me. Like, I actually kind of got mad at Joel Cohen. Like, hey, come on, this is just sloppy.
There was one other woman in this world. She was, secretary?
The woman with the... with her gut.
Oh yeah, yeah. Yeah. That oh one. Yeah. Oh yeah, yeah. No, two other women good. Then. Yeah. Two other women. Two ladies.
I forget about her.
The woman with her gut.
Woman with her gut.
I like that woman
with
her gut.
She's still rolling around with that guy with the pencil mustache.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That trope actually leads me to question whether he was already dead at this point, because there's just no reason for her to just come have sex with him, just like that.
Right. So do you think at any point in this movie, post his play, right? The play, right, and talking to his agent and all that. Is there anything after, like, when's the death? Because I'm all over the place with this. Was it in the room when the smoke was, you know, when he burned it? Maybe. Was it well before, and the hotel represents purgatory? I actually kind of like that idea. And
now,
also,
this is total film sack theory here. This is not a standing theory, listeners. This is a film sack on the fly theory. Yeah.
Isn't it a better film if he isn't dead, though? Just like, you know, if he does end up on the beach and he sees the woman, you know, striking the same pose as the painting, and he's carrying around the box with presumably somebody's head in it. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Doesn't it make it a better film?
It does. But the only problem, I love everything about it, and it's definitely if it is real, I like everything about it, except I still have this bridge that I have to gap between the supernatural of what John Goodman.
It is the biggest question. How does he get out of that building?
It is a really
important question to wonder, because that thing is so old that you think it's held together by matchsticks.
Plus, it was burning for a very long time. Like, it wasn't just...
Right. Yeah.
They were in there having all kinds of inner monologue and whatever, and him pulling the bed apart and getting him...
Right. Awesome. Like, why is it so hot in here?
Yeah. I made a great gif of that face, by the way. Him pulling on
that supernatural strength of... That is fun.
Yeah, it was
great. I was really hoping you'd pull a gif of Totoro's face while he was dancing at the USO concert.
That's great. What a jerk. And it really places his character in place when he's out dancing with those people about to go to war. And, you know, he's all like, what about me? I'm a writer.
So this was what year was that? 41. 41.
Yeah, right as we're entering the war.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Or right after Pearl Harbor, right?
Right after Pearl. Right around Pearl Harbor.
Yeah. Yeah, that would have been... Oh, my history's a little rusty on that.
December 7th, 1941.
Any other stuff for you on Duke Clips? You guys want
to do
clips?
If I'm going to have a moment where he stops being mortal and starts dreaming, at least, if not absolutely dead, it's got to happen before the studio boss, I'm forgetting his name, starts acting super inconsistently. Mm-hmm. Like, when they first meet, I'm like, okay, so that's how that guy is. And then every time you see him, he's a different person. Mm-hmm. Like, right. You know, like he's dressed differently. He's in a different place and he behaves in an inconsistent way from how you previously saw him.
Yeah.
That, and right. That character, like every other character, is pretty consistent, but that character is just all over the place. And I know he's supposed to be a story about how Hollywood is weird and you can't figure out what it wants from you from one moment to the next. But the scene out by the pool, I'm sorry, that is not congruent with the rest of that character. Mm-hmm. And so I just kind of want to, I want to explain that by, oh, well, we're clearly already dreaming at the very least before we get to that scene.
Right.
Are you...
poor Lou.
But, yeah, poor Lou indeed. What was I going to say about him? I had a thing to say about him. Oh, I know what I was going to say. When that lady's laying there next to him, he thinks she's just asleep, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
She's got a mosquito on her.
Right.
The first time I actually see the mosquito, by the way.
Right, right. I'm going to say that I don't think in his situation, even given who he is, I don't think anyone slaps that mosquito dead that hard.
on somebody's body.
Yeah, on somebody's body. Now, it's the thing that made him realize, oh, she's not alive, but come on now. Right. If she was, if your assumption is she's alive, you just kind of flick it away. You don't go,
right, whack! Exactly. Like, he's been frustrated by the thing.
He's been fighting it the whole time. But that's the thing. This other thing that makes me think that it's a dream, because he never actually sees the mosquito, and we're told that there's no mosquitoes there. However, once he wakes up from his sleep, which is what I'm assuming he continues to sleep, and he actually sees the mosquito, really, really, really sees it. And then from that point on. But yeah, that was disgusting when he smacked it and big old blood spot right there, and the rest of it just started leaking out. And I went, "Yep, I'm watching a Coen Brothers movie."
Yeah, I can't deal with that. Can't deal with it. It grosses me out.
It's one of those things though where you're like, it was shot really pretty. Mm-hmm. Like you see this and it's really cool, and you get like, "Oh, this is good filmmaking." But it's almost like the Coen Brothers are trying to trick you by saying, "Here, look at this. Now look at this. Now listen to this dialogue," and it doesn't have to make sense. Mm. You know?
Yeah.
Well, it doesn't. It was still good. I gave this movie in our little chat group on Slack. I kind of said, you know, Barton Fink sucks and that kind of stuff. But I enjoyed this movie overall. You know, I won't say it's. I wouldn't go back and watch it a bunch of times, but I enjoyed it. I had a fun ride.
Yeah. I would watch Raising Arizona, you know, 8 times a week if someone let me. But I would see this time, and maybe in a few years when I'm forget a bit, I'll see it again, maybe, or, you know. Mm-hmm. It's one
and
of
Scott, I'll have you know, the people who make Coen Brothers lists, Raising Arizona is always at the bottom. It's so weird.
No, I know. Mm-hmm. I know it is.
I don't understand.
I think people see it as more of a mainstream comedy and a thing that was, I don't know, like more commercial maybe for them.
Mm-hmm.
But I completely disagree. I think it's like, I mean, yes, it's funny. It's one of the funnier ones, but that's true of a lot of their movies. So I don't know. It's not like it's out of
character for them too. I would understand if it was like, well, it's a good movie, but it isn't. It doesn't feel like a Coen Brothers movie. But that thing reeks of Coen Brothers movie. So
right. Yeah, but you can't feel superior to other people when you talk about Raising Arizona being your favorite.
Yeah, exactly.
You have to go. I like Boston Fink.
Yeah, people go. No, like listen. Boston
Fink. You can't possibly understand it.
I find Miller's Crossing to just be a sublime experience.
Yes, and if I'm not inside Llewyn Davis, then who am I? Yeah, it's just that's what that is. Yeah. That's uppity poopity is what that is. All right, I'm gonna play
your emails, people.
Yeah, I'm gonna do some clips. Okay, so here's one about fish.
Fish, fresh fish.
I like that because that was just an off camera, off stage guy whose job it was to walk up and yell, "Fish, fresh fish."
The fishmonger.
That's some Coen Brothers business right there, the way that worked
out.
Here's a eyebrow guy from Gladiator. You guys may not have noticed him, but early on in the film, the guy who plays the Gladiator shot caller, basically, in Gladiator, where he's like, "Maximus Aurelius, whatever, versus the deal." That guy is this guy.
Barton, Barton, so glad you could make it. You know Richard St. Clair and Poppy Conahan.
And he's got the eyebrows and everything. That guy's great.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he's great. Love that guy. Buscemi shows up and says one word.
"Welcome to the Hotel Earl. May I help you, sir?"
That's pretty much it from him, the whole rest of the movie.
Except for Chet.
Chet. Oh, yeah, Chet.
Name some famous Chets. This one and Weird Science. That's all I got.
Weird Science, Chet.
Chet Baker.
Chet. Who's Chet Baker?
Jazz musician.
Oh. I thought you meant movie characters. Chet.
And then there's a rock musician named Chet Faker that does.
Oh, there's plenty
covers.
Of music Chets. I'm not talking about musical Chets.
Oh, Chet Atkins and.
Yeah.
I can't think of any other Chets. It's all the
I'm
Chets.
Talking
I
about
got.
Actor Chets.
Yeah.
Character Chets.
Piece of Chet.
Machete.
There you go.
Chet Hanks.
Here's a sore butt John Chet Goodman. Lee? Oh, Chet Lee. The famous.
Oh, rent martial arts.
Yeah, there you go.
Chet Lee.
We can't get Chet Lee. All right, hired Chet Lee.
Hired Chet Lee.
We'll take what we can get. All right, here's John Goodman saying a thing Brian Dunaway likes.
I can feel my butt getting sore already.
All right. There's a real clarity to that.
I could feel my butt getting sore already.
Some good sound work in this movie.
Yeah.
I wonder if anybody else had the problem I did. I've seen Oh Brother, Where Art Thou 50 times. Mm.
Right.
And so the John Turturro versus John Goodman thing was just like, it felt like borrowed from the future for
them. Yeah, that's funny that you say that. I had the same, because I just recently watched that again, and it definitely feels... I mean, whatever. The Coen brothers always bring their people forward to all their other movies, right. And so it's unavoidable.
They've got to have Buscemi. They've got to have Goodman. They've got to have Francis McDormand.
George Clooney.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Twice. They only had him twice. But yeah, like, who's another one they'd like to always bring? Oh, the guy, the assistant to the movie mogul guy is always in these movies.
Oh, yeah, right. He was Hudsucker, wasn't he, in the Hudsucker proxy?
No, he was, that was Papio Daniel from the other one. I can't think of any names.
Oh, right. Right,
and he was also the guy,
he was in the Big Lebowski, Crossing.
Yeah, he's in tons of them.
All right, just looked it up, Scott. Four Coen Brother movies for George Clooney.
Oh, what are the other two?
All right, so Burn After Reading.
No,
Hail Caesar.
Oh, Hail Caesar.
Oh, brother, where art thou? And Intolerable Cruelty.
But he's not.
About Intolerable.
He's
Cruelty.
In Burn After Reading.
Yeah.
Oh, I've not seen that. That's why I didn't know.
Yeah, Scott.
I thought that was Brad Pitt, or I guess it is Brad Pitt, but it's also Brad Pitt, right? Isn't Brad Pitt in that? Brad Pitt's in that.
Yes. Yeah, and Francis McDormand and John Malkovich and Tilda Swinton.
Mm. Is it going to be so weird that you're going to be thinking Ocean's 11 the whole time when you see that, Scott?
Oh my gosh. I can't be. And I'll think of Ocean's 12. All right. Here comes the dude from Wings, is what I wrote, but I meant.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, I meant that guy.
Need Indians for Norman Steele, Weston.
I'm a writer.
Ted Oakham.
Think about everything. Writers come and go. We always need Indians.
I'm a writer. Ted Oakham said you're producing this Wallace Beery picture I'm working on.
Ah, Ted Oakham doesn't know shit. They've assigned me enough pictures for a goddamn year. Listen, what Ted Oakham doesn't know, you could almost squeeze into the Hollywood Bowl.
I loved his part in this.
Yeah, it was so much fun.
I think Tony Shalhoub is the man. I like that guy a lot.
Yeah, yeah. What does his butt smell like this morning? Yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah, that phone conversation was amazing. So good.
That's great.
Yeah.
And I apologize for banging on about this, but it's fascinating. Three actors have been in six Coen Brothers movies. Those are Steve Buscemi, John Goodman, and Frances McDormand.
Just remember, we don't like to make lists. But go ahead.
I know.
She's in this.
I'm not making a list. I'm just naming.
She's in this too, by the way. Well, she's married to Ethan Coen, so that kind of helps. But she's in this movie. She's a voice on the stage, but not in it.
Continue, Randy.
Yeah, she's just talking.
Give us your
list. And then one has made five, and that's John Polito.
John Polito.
John the guy with he's bald guy with a thin mustache also.
Mm-hmm. Right.
He's the assistant to Lipnick. Is that right?
Right. Yeah. He's the one who ends up getting canned.
Yeah.
Yes. Right.
That guy. Right. He was on Seinfeld even. That guy. He's been around. He's done some stuff.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Here's Frasier's dad. Okay. So here you go.
All of us undomesticated riders eventually make our way out here to the Great Salt Lick. That's probably why I always have such a powerful thirst. A little social lubricant, Mr. Fink?
Yeah. No.
I just realized he said Salt Lick. I thought he said Salt Lake, and it was confusing me because I'm like, Salt Lake is not in.
No.
And I thought maybe I was wrong.
We were never part of Hollywood, as far as I know.
Right.
Yeah, Salt Lick, meaning he had, he's like a goat, had to go find a salt lick, or a cow, I guess. There's certain animals go find a salt lick, right? The cow, is it a cow?
Everything that needs salt. So
I'm about to say, any organic mammal outside, if you put a salt cube somewhere, some animal will come and lick it.
Yeah. So. Your neighbor Dave, Brian. Salt. Your neighbor Dave would do it.
It's just, it's like a, right, you could just lay put a bunch of salt on the ground and hide right. behind a bush and then catch something.
Yeah.
That's kind of how you hunt for deer. Like,
Oh, sure.
I ain't never hunting no deer. I don't know how that works. All right, here's a...
Just make sure you hide upwind.
John Goodman making noises.
Come.
There you go.
Come on.
That's when he's asking. That's when he's beckoning him to wrestle or have floor sex. Right.
Oh, yeah. That's where I would have just left town.
Mm-hmm.
That moment, if I was Barton Fink and he's on hands and knees, I'm just like, you know what? I'm going back to New York City right now.
So you say when John Goodman presents himself to you?
Yes, exactly. That's exactly what that was.
Present himself. I hate the term presenting. Like when your dog, when you got a dog and heat. Oh, she's presenting. Oh shit. Don't say it out loud. I hate it. I hate it. And there, I remember a teacher took us to the zoo for a field trip to the zoo when I was a kid, and I'll never forget the zoo lady who was giving us the tour said, "Oh, the baboons are presenting." And I'm like, gosh, dang it, dude. They're making. I was horrified by that. All right,
I'm sorry. You have some times in your childhood that are just horrifying.
Well, they're horrifying, but
scarring.
They're not scarring times. The funny thing is, they're like pretty no big deal, right? Like the word presenting, right. and it's true. And you know, if you're at animal husbandry, would teach you all you need to know and whatever. But I just, as a kid, was just like, that's a giant purple butt. What is presenting? We're all gonna die.
Anyway. We're all afraid as children to walk in on our mom or dad presenting.
Yeah,
in their room.
I do not want to see. I only heard my parents presenting. I never saw them presenting. I remember staying up in high school. I would stay up late to watch Letterman at midnight, right? And this back before he was, when he was doing Late Night with David Letterman on NBC at like midnight. And so I would stay up all night. And I remember one night, I'm like, what is that sound? So I'd mute the TV downstairs and I hear this. Ear, 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 ear.
Oh, no.
And I just about went and did John Goodman chunks in the toilet. I was so grossed out. All right,
So I'm about 13 years old, and I have this tradition with all my closest friends live in the same neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And so every Friday night or Saturday night, someone is spending the night at someone's house.
Yeah.
And at the time, I didn't realize it was generally my parents getting rid of me and paying paying back other parents for getting rid of me. So this was like for years, every Friday and or Saturday night, I'm staying at somebody's house or they're staying at my house. And it's among about three or four guys. So I'm 13-ish. And I walk to my buddy's house to spend the night at, 7 PM on a Friday. And he lives a mile away. So it's a good long walk. When I get to his house, I realize I've forgotten the one most important thing.
You never go back.
I was supposed to tell. So I walk all the way back to my house.
Oh, no.
And by the time I get there, it's like a good 45 minutes has passed since I left to go spend the night. Now, if you know my parents, these were not people who did stuff like this ever. They didn't talk about anything like there's the most conservative people in the world. I have two siblings. We always joke my parents had sex three times. I walk into my house, just come ambling right in, and they didn't lock the door, morons.
Mm-hmm.
And I come walking right in, and my mom is in this black negligee that I'm not sure that she owned before that minute. I'm really not.
Oh, that's funny.
It's like that's how disturbing this is to me, because it's so I'm seeing my mom in the thing, and she's not looking like my mom, because I just like. Everything is wrong. And so I just walk right past them in the living room, and she's wearing this black negligee, and I go to my room and I get my thing, and then I just walk right past them again out the front door.
Silently.
No words are spoken. There no glances are given or taken.
Mm-hmm.
And I walk to my friend's house, and it doesn't really catch in my brain what I saw or what was happening until I get to my buddy's house, and he has an older brother.
Mm.
And then I get an explanation.
Oh, no.
Oh, yeah. Then you got the full Monty. Then.
And I wish that hadn't happened because the older brother probably put more in my head than was actually going on.
Oh, yeah. You know? Of course. Yeah. He's in no position to give you a good ride that day.
As you're telling that story, Randy, every time you'd pause, I'd like think, oh, my God, it's going to be leather. There's going to be a key party. And like every time you pause, I thought there was something really bad coming around the corner.
Yeah.
I was relieved that it was just negligee.
It's just
my mom in a black negligee. You just don't understand how far off that is from my reality.
Yeah.
At that time.
Wow. All right. How to wrestle.
Now, when I say ready, wrestle, you try and pin me and I try and pin you. That's a whole game. Got it?
Wow. That's it.
that's what your mom told your dad.
Yeah. Wrestling simplified.
Hey, brother. Here's what's going to happen, brother.
Wrestling for dummies. All right. Here's I put funny bit. I don't know what it is.
If I close my eyes, I can almost smell the live oak.
That's chicken fat, Bill.
Well, my olfactory's turning womanish on me.
My olfactory's turning womanish on me. Now, that is Coen Brothers stuff, man. Yeah. I love stupid sayings that I can't get out of my head. Like, didn't we tell you not to do that?
I told you not to tell me that.
Yeah, I love that stuff. All right.
I'm walking in here on my knees.
Here's the best thing that Frasier's dad said the entire movie. Here you go.
Scrutiny.
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 I'm going to play that all the time.
Scrutiny.
Scrutiny. All right.
Scrutiny into a two-syllable word.
Angry acting.
Jesus, the grand product of days. What a goddamn phony. W.P. Mayo. William goddamn phony Mayo. Well, let's come on and escape. I'll say you escape.
What he said at the end.
Jesus.
I can see you feel pretty strongly about it, yeah. Mr. Fink.
Y'all need to shut up.
Yeah. It was some real scrutiny.
We used to talk about angry acting a lot on Film Sack, and I think we've gotten to where we're just overwhelmed by it, and it's just not even...
Yeah.
Yeah, it doesn't even need to come up in the checklist anymore because it's so common.
Every movie has it, turns out. It's a trick that we're finding.
Scrutiny.
After further scrutiny, I've seen a lot of angry acting in these movies. Here's Barton Fink screaming in the bed. All right.
One of my favorite male actor screams I have ever heard.
He's got good ones.
It's up there with Daniel Stern kind of screaming. Yeah.
Add it to the playlist of screams that we've come across. That's should be near the top.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
And you gotta love... what they do a couple times in the movie with John Goodman, you know, you're watching the wall, right, and hearing the sounds of John Goodman coming around.
Only John Goodman can make that much noise traveling from one room to another.
When he first came over about the complaints, it freaked me out. Like, it gave me the willies. I didn't like it.
That was playing very much to a man fear of tattling on your neighbor and then being confronted.
Yeah, I mean, if that was on purpose, they're brilliant because that really got under my skin. I hate that. I hate that whole, hey guys, it's a little late and your music's a little bit like, oh, that whole thing. I can't do dude.
Let me recommend you don't see the movie Neighbors with
God.
Seth Rogen and Zac Efron.
Yes.
I don't think I could do it. Scott? I haven't seen it. I think I avoided it for that reason. I hate that stuff.
You will be so uncomfortable.
Yeah. I mean, as someone who's had an actual row with an actual neighbor in recent memory, I hate that stuff so bad. Oh my gosh. I just want people to be responsible and live decent lives and stay away from me. That's all I want. If I could just have that, that'd be great. All right, thanks, Barton Fink. Here's I don't know what this is.
Barton, are you all right?
No, I'm fine, thank you.
Are you sure?
No.
I love how he's like, no, I'm fine, thank you. Are you sure? No?
I'm so glad you capped that because it was my favorite thing in the whole movie. That whole bit.
I'm about to do something that may upset a lot of listeners. I don't know.
Oh, nice. Great. Because we haven't had that recently.
Yeah. I don't want to make anybody not like this show anymore, but I just want you to feel the pain in case you skip the movie, because a lot of people do, and they just, you know, there's a fair amount of our listeners just like hear us talk about it and don't while they're seeing the films themselves. I will now subject you to 7 seconds of something. Here it is.
Brilliant. I That's some good. That is some good.
That's like that is stew, like pouring stew into a toilet.
Yeah, someone had canned vegetables and they were just dropping it right into a toilet with a microphone next to them.
So gross. I hate it. I'm so glad it's out of my system now. All right, here's Bible Pete. Oh, no, it's Pete in the elevator. This is a weird conversation.
Who read the Bible, Pete?
Holy Bible?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so. Anyway, I've heard about it.
I love that because that's such a... It frames that the Bible stories are like a Hollywood production, and that you, if you're not aware of it, you have to at least feign that you've heard about it, so that you're not out of the loop.
Even the Hollywood Hotel elevator operator is playing the game, and he's like his breathing is just. I'm like, you're no way you survive that fire when that fire goes.
Right,
that's not going to work out.
Between him and John Goodman, there was a lot of close-up heavy breathing that happened. Mm-hmm.
Here's one of my favorite lines in the thing. He was talking to the cops, and he said this.
He's a man. We wrestled.
There you go. We'll keep that for a long time.
He's a man. We wrestled.
Screw me.
All right, great. Hey, there's your clips. That means it's time for this. Oh, it's the film sack checklist, and here it is. Sweaty Goodman, check. Very sweaty. The hotel only has one employee, check. And one line Buscemi, check. Star Trek connections, we have a few here. Scott Schneider, who was a model maker for this, was on TNG, worked on two Klingon ship models in 1988. He was also the model maker for Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country. Then we got Max Grodenchik. He was the clapper boy. In DS9, he played Rom.
I totally missed him in this movie.
Really?
Yeah.
What?
Yep. Rom.
During the dailies when he's looking at the daily shoots.
Yep.
Yeah.
That was Rom.
I totally missed it.
And then USO Girl on TNG play. This is Jaina Mary Hupp. She played Ensign Pavlik on the episode Galaxy's Child and played Lieutenant Monroe in the episode Disaster. So there you go. It's a good connection today, I think.
Yeah.
Soundtrack great. I give it a W for weird. I don't really even remember what it sounded like, to be honest. It was just kind
of
creepy
and
weird.
A lot of strings, violins, a lot of intense violining.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Now you guys get to sum it up in 140 characters or less. Let's start with Randy.
Barton Fink. Hollywood sometimes kisses your feet and sometimes kills you and always leaves you confused and weary. The 507th movie in a 1,000 movie series.
Nice. A lot of shoe fetish in this movie.
Oh, yeah. Lots of shoe stuff going on. He grabbed his shoe. Remember the movie guy grabbing his shoe and like holding it real tight in his swimming suit and all that? Yeah.
Yep.
Brian Dunaway.
Barton Fink. Like a couple of statues of guys in diapers holding up the world. You just got to assume there's some sort of incontinence involved. Toilet.
Well said.
Toilet. Finally,
Brian Ibbett.
Barton Fink. The last time I saw this many quirky guys named John in the same place, I was at a They Might Be Giants concert.
Nice. You know what's funny is
John Turturro, John Mahoney.
Yep. It's funny you should say that because I actually conflate, but when I think of Coen Brothers movies or I think of They Might Be Giants, I often think of the other side. I often compare them. And that's weird, isn't it? A little bit.
It is weird. Yeah. And it's weird that they've never done, you'd think that they would do a collaboration because there is that kind of commonality of
something. They're just cut from the same cloth.
Old
right?
as new kind of pencil thin mustaches would be appropriate in both cases.
Right.
You know,
It's just a weird, it's weird how one evokes the other for me. And it's not like I've ever seen them together in the same place. I just think of them whenever you say it. Like you could say 10,000 Maniacs and I go, oh, I could really go for some True Grit right now for some reason. Anyway.
Huh.
Let's
All right, that one, I don't know.
Well, I don't know. I mean, just pull it out of my butt. Pull it out of my butt. Oh, man, love True Grit. I want to watch True Grit again. I love that movie. Let's do the what now? Oh, alternate title. I got that right here. Hold on. There it is. The Meat in the Miller's Crossing Hudsucker Proxy Sandwich, or...
Yeah.
I'm your fire starter.
I'm your fire starter.
Email from Daniel Holohan sent it to filmsack@gmail.com. And he says this. Word, homies. We sure this isn't Mike Iceberg.
Is it Mike Boyd?
Yeah, yeah. It might be Mike.
Sup, dog?
On Twitter, Scott says he liked my idea of doing an episode about Titanic. Should I keep holding my breath while it's still streaming on Netflix or let my dreams go down with the ship? It's pretty good. P.S. In the past week, I watched Phenomenon and Cape Fear, followed each viewing with the accompanying episode of FilmSack. What a super fun experience. It's what you dream of doing with friends after everyone watches a movie together, but it never quite works out that way. Someone is always pregnant or getting a divorce or still supports Trump or does CrossFit. This is a great email.
There's a lot of personal stuff going on in his life.
It really is.
Okay, but first question. You may not know, early on and sticking with that rule since the beginning of FilmSack, Scott said we would never watch a film for FilmSack that was significantly more than 2 hours long.
Yeah,
it just it puts
that.
A lot of strain on Scott to prepare the show.
And the rest of us to watch if it's shitty. Like, it's just a hard 3 hours, a long time to commit to a thing.
However,
so I think you said that right after Dune, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
That's the Dune.
The Dune
addendum.
Rule.
Yeah, that Dune addendum.
Having said that, there have to be exceptions, right? A good rule needs exceptions.
Sure.
And the fact is, since we've all seen Titanic, it might fall into the exceptions where Scott could just skip it. You know, like he could skip through it. He could skip past parts of it, you know, any of us could. Anybody who's watching Titanic, if you're watching it for the first time, seriously, skip the middle like 45 minutes.
Yeah.
No. But, no. You never skip anything in a FilmSack movie. I'm sorry. That's I'm sorry. I put my foot down. I will leave the show if I hear that anybody like fast forwarded through half the movie. Because
this is a shared experience of hell, exactly. And you're not getting out of it.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah,
I mean, it is the world's. Isn't it still number one spot for the most money made, adjusting for inflation, the period across the board? Right? Isn't it still the number one movie?
Like, that or Avatar? Did Avatar surpass it?
I thought Avatar didn't quite.
Cameron, stupid money making.
Oh, dude, that guy. He's the most money making former Roger Corman employee ever, because he used to work for Corman and then left. Not Roger Corman. Yeah, Roger Corman. Yeah, the Death Race guy. He used to do. He's one of those guys, like Ron Howard, like there's a whole handful of these guys. They all worked for Roger Corman for pennies, and then went on to be huge themselves.
When in doubt, go to the numbers or Box Office Mojo. The answer is number one is still Gone with the Wind. When adjusted for inflation, Gone with the Wind benefits from its age. Number two is Avatar. Number three is Star Wars Episode IV. And number four is Titanic.
Okay, so without
the
adjustment
next to it, what does that mean?
Without the translation.
Adjusted for inflation.
What if you
not
don't have
adjusted
that?
For inflation? It's Avatar, Titanic, and then Force Awakens.
Oh, we got a new number three, do we?
Yeah, not adjusted.
And then not adjusted. Hmm. Okay. Well, then that's interesting. Take that. I frankly, my dear, we're still number one. Damn it.
That Gone with the Wind thing, because I mean, what other movies were released on that weekend?
Yeah, well, that year maybe, that whole year.
No competition.
There was a couple of stag films and a silent shitty movie, and that was it.
Right. So to answer
Fatty Arbuckle snuff film.
Yeah.
To answer your question, Dunaway, Titanic is controversial on the list because it was re-released twice, and years and years, like 15 years after its original release. It was released again, and so they don't know what to do with those additional grosses.
Interesting. But. And, you know, E.T. did the same thing, but you don't see a T next to it. Weird.
Yeah.
Weird.
Also, I've never seen Dr. Zhivago.
Oh, that's a very boring film. I recommend not seeing it. It's not great. My mom was way into that. It was like, you'd go to my house, and you'd say, movies, talk, whatever. Everyone's talking about movies, and my mom would go, oh, I just love that Dr. Zhivago. She loved that movie, and we hated it as kids. She'd try to make us watch it. It's like 3 hours of drip. It's awful.
3 hours of drip.
Yeah. It was like, Russian doctor guy. It sucks. It sucks. Watch Dr. Strangelove instead. That's about it.
Oh, yeah.
If you got to choose a doctor, it's Dr. Strangelove.
Yeah. It's way better. Right. But Dr. Zhivago. We're like, Mom, can I watch Condor Man again? No, we're watching Dr. Zhivago.
Condor Man.
I know, right?
You guys remember
Condor Man? I haven't
thought
about that movie in 30 years.
That was a Disney hero, brand new hero movie from Walt Disney back in the day, and it is awesome. We should watch Condor Man when it streams.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, no question about it. Well, Daniel Holloman, Who knows? Time will tell. Maybe. I don't know. But what is our next film, Randy? What are we doing instead? What's happening next week?
Oh, you would ask now.
Yeah, I would ask.
Yeah, at the end of the show. Ridiculous.
I have no idea. You need to vamp for like two minutes.
I can tell you now. It's good. Superman 3.
Oh, yes. I thought
it was doing 4.
Yeah, I thought we were skipping to 4. Aren't we skipping to 4?
Well, nobody changed the spreadsheet.
Oh.
I just want to say
the spreadsheet, guys.
I just want to say in preparation for Superman 3, I've been watching Superman 1 and 2.
Yeah.
Right. And
go ahead and enjoy 3 because we're going to skip right to 4, I think, is what we're wanting.
Okay, I just changed the spreadsheet. Superman 4 is now our next film.
Yes, because F3. We're not doing 3. I don't want to do 3.
I'm fine with that.
Yeah, I think 3's been done to death. 4 is a pile of steam.
We got to see Nuclear Man on the moon fighting him.
We've gotten our quota of Richard Pryor, so Richard Pryor, I'm cool with that.
Yeah, so let's do that. Red Superman 4, everybody. The Quest for Peace. It's an allegory or a allegorical look at the height of the Cold War in the 80s, and it's all very anti-nuke.
Nuclear Man.
Yeah, it's very anti-nuke. The whole thing is very anti-nuke, and Russia and America are like always at odds and all that. Kind of like now. Anyway, hey, let's take our leave. Before we do though, a quick note that if you'd like to find all this stuff on the internet, filmsack.com is the website. And if you're so inclined, you can comment on the blog and have conversations. People are always in there chatting about the movies we watch and the thoughts you might have. And we take all comers, all takers. So just come on in and set a spell. Voicemails can be sent to 801-471-0462. And you can email us, filmsack@gmail.com, of course. You can find us on Twitter, @FilmSack. And we'd love reviews wherever you get your podcasts. That helps us a lot by helping others discover the show. Way more than just getting good reviews. It helps people find it. That's going to do it for us, for me, for Brian, and for Randy. Mm-hmm. We'll see you next time.
Where's my honey? My water's lapping up.
In the toilet.
This show is part of the Frog Pants Network. Yes. Get more at frogpants.com.
Screw.